John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
WSQT, Direct Action Radio in Exile. Over the internet, returning to the air as soon as a new transmitter location and frequency can be found.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for May 22nd through June 3rd, 2011. This week is a series of important political and other events. There was a series of attacks on non-violent demonstrators. French Foreign Minister set out his government's peace plan for the Middle East. And there were preparations on both sides for Naxa Day on Sunday. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let us begin our weekly report, as usual, with the non-violent activities in the West Bank. Six civilians were injured on Friday and many more were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation when Israeli troops attacked the weekly anti-wall protests in a number of West Bank communities. This week, protests were reported in the villages of Al-Nabi Salam, Bilin and Nilin in the central West Bank, as well as Al-Masra in the south. One man was injured in the leg and two dozen were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation as the troops attacked the weekly protest in the village of Al-Nabi Salam, central West Bank. On Friday morning, villagers and their international and Israeli supporters gathered near land where Israel plans to build a new settlement. Troops attacked villages as soon as they left and later invaded the village and fired tear gas into people's homes. Later, after the midday prayers, protesters marched again to the settlement construction site where troops attacked them with more tear gas before leaving the village. One man was hit with a tear gas bomb, injuring his hand. Troops later invaded the village and took over homes, including the house of Bassem Al-Tamimi, a local activist who has been detained by the Israeli military for the past 6 months. Similarly, in Bilayin village, a journalist was injured and many more were treated for tear gas inhalation after troops attacked the protest. Residents of Bilayin have been protesting at the wall for the past 6 years. International and Israeli supporters joined the villagers after the midday prayers. As soon as people reached the gate of the wall separating villagers from their lands, troops fired tear gas and sound bombs. Khalid Sabarna, 45, a local journalist, was injured when a tear gas bomb hit him in the hand. Further protests were held in the nearby village of Nilayin, where the residents and their Israeli and international supporters held the Friday midday prayers near the Israeli wall. The protesters then marched up to the wall, marking the third year of their resistance against it. Troops fired tear gas and live rounds at protesters, causing minor injuries to four. Furthermore, troops fired tear gas at nearby olive orchards, where a number of olive trees caught fire. Elsewhere in the same day, villagers and their international and Israeli supporters protested against the wall, and in settlements in Al-Masra village in the southern West Bank, Israeli troops stopped villagers from reaching the construction site of the wall and pushed people back into the village, where the protest ended without any further clashes. As Palestinian-Israeli peace process is going through the hardest times ever, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and his Israeli counterpart Shimon Peres discussed this week possibilities of advanced peace. Rami Al-Maghari has more.
The meeting between the two leaders came on the sideline of a celebration ceremony in Rome on the 150th anniversary of the reunification of Italy. Both presidents were reported to have discussed this stalled peace away from media outlets. Shimon Peres said this week that the Palestinian Authority would likely gain a recognition of a Palestinian state by September of this year at the United Nations. Meanwhile, other Israeli leaders, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, believed that a UN recognition of a Palestinian state on 1967 borders would not help the Palestinians unless such a declaration comes out of direct negotiations between the Israeli and Palestinian sides. Palestinian Authority's President Mahmoud Abbas, along with his negotiating team, have been boycotting the Israeli side over what Palestinians contend continued Israeli settlement activities on occupied Palestinian lands, mainly in East Jerusalem, which Israeli PM said this week would remain the united capital of Israel. Palestinians have repeatedly demanded a freeze of all settlement activities in order to pave the way for a two-state solution based on the 1967 borders, including West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. At the internal Palestinian level, the major Palestinian parties Fatah and Hamas signaled this week possibility for forming a technocratic government that would prepare for elections to select a unity government between them. In a period of 2 weeks, Ghazi Hamad is deputy foreign minister of the ruling Hamas party in Gaza.
So I think it's now, it's a time now to say, to have a new platform, a new strategy, to work together. It's not the program of Fatah or a program of Hamas or a program of Islamic Jihad. Now we have to work for what's called the national platform, a national program.
In other news, Israeli and Palestinian sources denied Egyptian reports suggesting that a prisoner swap deal between Israel and Hamas has been reached recently. The Cairo-based Al-Misriyun, or Egyptians newspaper, quoted former Egyptian ambassador to Tel Aviv, Mohammed Bisyuni, as saying that Cairo concluded the deal that would see the release of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners in return for captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who Hamas has been capturing in Gaza for 4 years now. Bisyuni also refuted those reports. Rami Al-Maghari, IMEMC.org, Gaza.
This week was marked with a series of arrests, housing demolitions, assaults and military incursions. The details with IMEMC's David Steele.
On the afternoon of Friday the 27th of May, the Israeli police attacked Israeli and Palestinian activists as they held a non-violent protest in front of Har Hazatim, an illegal Israeli settlement in Ras Al-Amud neighbourhood in occupied East Jerusalem, and abducted one Palestinian protester. An elderly Palestinian shepherd, Hamid Al-Kait, 67, was admitted to hospital on the same day with a fractured skull, internal bleeding and bruising throughout his body after he was attacked and beaten by a group of 12 Israeli settlers south of Nablus. The incident took place in Madama village, near the city of Nablus in the northern West Bank. According to eyewitnesses, the settlers came by foot from the nearby settlement of Yitzhar, a small outpost established by extreme right-wing Israeli settlers in the middle of several Palestinian-populated areas and far east of the 1967 armistice line between Israel and Palestine. Al-Ket was found by relatives and taken to hospital in Nablus, where he remains in critical condition. On Saturday evening, Israeli soldiers detained three international peace activists and one Palestinian as the army attacked the weekly non-violent protest in Iraq Burin village, south of the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Soldiers fired gas bombs and rubber-coated bullets at protesters, leading to several injuries. A group of extremist Israeli settlers living in the Beit Ayin settlement, built on Palestinian lands, belong to the Beit Omar village, north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron, on Saturday attacked Palestinian orchards and uprooted 20 olive trees. The attacked lands belong to members of the Abu Jaber Azlaibi family. Eyewitnesses said that Israeli soldiers were present in the area but did not stop the settlers. Soldiers did, however, prevent residents from reaching their vineyards and olive orchards. Israeli soldiers have prevented university lecturer Dr. Farid Abu Zair from travelling to Jordan as he was trying to cross the Allenby Bridge to be with his son, who has surgery scheduled at a Jordanian hospital. Abu Zair teaches at Al-Najah University in the northern West Bank city of Nablus. On Saturday evening, Israeli soldiers detained five Palestinians, including women and children, and kidnapped an international activist near Safa village, north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. The residents were working in their farmlands before extremist settlers of the Beit Ayin settlement attacked them and uprooted olive trees. Israeli soldiers arrived at the scene and declared a closed military zone, a pretext often used to arrest and intimidate Palestinian farmers and their supporters. The closed military zone is in fact the agricultural lands owned by the residents of the village. Palestinian medical sources in the Gaza Strip reported that Israeli soldiers shot and injured a Palestinian man on Sunday at dawn, east of Al-Zaitun neighbourhood in Gaza City. The wounded resident suffered moderate wounds and is currently in a stable condition. The shots came from soldiers stationed at an Israeli military tower, the Al-Malaka military base, east of Al-Zaitun. Israeli authorities forced Mahmoud Aramin to demolish his house in East Jerusalem on Sunday, or risk having it destroyed by an Israeli bulldozer, which would have incurred an exorbitant fine. Aramin had already paid thousands of dollars in fines to the Jerusalem municipality in monthly instalments for having built an unlicensed house in East Jerusalem. Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem have not been granted building permits since 1967 and face frequent demolitions of their homes by Israeli authorities. Under Article 53 of the 4th Geneva Convention, home demolition by an occupying power is strictly illegal unless rendered absolutely necessary by military operations. The Palestinian Journalists Forum in Gaza issued a statement denouncing the Israeli police for attacking Palestinian journalists reporting on clashes that took place in the Ras al-Amud neighbourhood in East Jerusalem. Between 200 and 300 Israeli settlers infiltrated Nablus and called for the Israeli military to re-establish control in the area after they broke free from the Israeli security forces accompanying them. The group was part of some 1,500 Israelis who were visiting nearby Joseph's tomb. 50 of the same group barricaded themselves into the religious site and refused to leave. The group stayed until dawn and clashed with Israeli military forces that tried to remove them. One military driver sustained injuries during the clashes. The Palestinian Authority is to bring legal proceedings due to the property damage caused by the settlers during the incident. All such visits should be agreed with the PA in advance, according to the Oslo Accords, which established Palestinian Authority civic and security control of Ramallah and Nablus. The visit had not been coordinated with the PA, according to PA spokespeople. Israeli forces raided the West Bank city of Jenin and nearby villages, detaining 12 Islamic Jihad forces and closing a charity. The raids, which took place between 3 and 4 a.m, targeted Islamic Jihad members, who Israel accuses of orchestrating and financing planned terrorist attacks. As part of the raid, the military took computers and documents from a charitable organisation called the Muslim Girl. Israeli officials claim that the charity, belonging to university lecturer Muna Qidan, has links with the Islamic Jihad organisation. Qidan was also detained during the raid. On Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers attacked Khurbet Yizra village in the Jordan Valley, Pride West Bank, and displaced its residents under the claim that the area is a closed military zone. Local sources reported that the soldiers displaced more than 200 shepherds living in the area after surrounding and isolating it. Mukhlis Masaid, head of the Khurbet Yizra village council, noted that there were already three military bases in the area and that several residents have been killed and wounded by stray bullets. On Tuesday, the army demolished 13 structures owned by Arab Bedouin in the Al-Faraseya and Al-Maita areas in Wadi Al-Malah in the northern Jordan Valley. 8 homes were demolished in the Al-Maita area of the upper Wadi Malah, home to hundreds of Bedouin, although the homes are far away from Israeli military camps. 6 more homes were levelled in the nearby Al-Faraseya area. The attack is one of several similar attacks carried out by the army in the same area in the last few months. On Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers abducted 3 children in the southern West Bank city of Hebron and took them to an unknown location. Troops installed roadblocks in the Hebron district, invaded several nearby villages and towns, broke into and searched several homes, causing damage. Furthermore, soldiers invaded the nearby towns and villages of Ithna, Yatta and Beit Anun and installed roadblocks leading to Halhul, Ithna and Beit Awa, in addition to the Asihla and Al-Talat Abu Hadid areas. Also, soldiers invaded Beit Amra, north of Yatta in the Hebron district, and imposed a curfew before breaking into several homes and searching them, causing damage to property. Resident Ala Mohammed Deis, 25, said that soldiers violently attacked his 55-year-old soldier while searching his home and destroyed property. Deis added that soldiers also destroyed some of the walls in his father's home and the home of one of their relatives, and searched several nearby homes. Also on Wednesday, a Palestinian worker from Bethlehem suffered bruises and concussion after being violently attacked and beaten by Israeli soldiers and police officers as he was working at a construction site in East Jerusalem. The resident, Ead Obeyat, 30, was working in Sur Bahar village, east of Jerusalem. The soldiers kidnapped him and took him to a different location where he was violently assaulted before being released. He was moved to the Beit Jala governmental hospital suffering serious injuries. On Wednesday evening, Israeli soldiers invaded Kafr al-Lubad village, east of the northern West Bank city of Tulkarm, broke into a school construction site and interrogated several residents. Local sources reported that after breaking into the site, it was searched with military dogs, and that the surrounding areas were similarly searched. On Thursday, a group of extremist settlers in the Yitzhar illegal settlement near the northern West Bank city of Nablus attacked Madama Palestinian village and torched Palestinian fields planted with wheat. Following the attack, police arrived at the scene and fired gas bombs at local Palestinians who had clashed with the settlers. No injuries were reported. In another incident on the same day, settlers allegedly blocked a road between Nablus and Qalqiya, preventing Palestinians from using it. As'ad al-Tawil, 15, Adnan al-Tawil, 35, and Awad al-Tawil, 40, were all taken to hospital with what are described as moderate injuries. Under international law, all settlements in the occupied territories, including occupied East Jerusalem, are illegal. For IMEMC.org, this is David Steele.
And that was just some of the news from This Week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hussam Qassis and me, Kevin Murphy.
Recall that on the 23rd of May, a member of Code Pink was seriously assaulted by security guards at the AIPAC, American-Israeli Political Action Committee convention, after she shouted down Israel's prime minister in response to his blunt statements that Israel would never compromise on Jerusalem.
My friends, Israel and America...
Occupying land is indefensible!
Here's what she had to say afterwards about having been assaulted and sent to the hospital.
I stood up and unfurled a banner and spoke the truth about what's going on in Israel. The war crimes and occupation, oppression and inequality that Palestinians are suffering from must end. And it was absolutely despicable to see our Congress pandering to Netanyahu as if he was the president of the United States. And I think after seeing this speech, every American should be outraged, and the progressive community needs to rise up and take courage and take action for justice, democracy, freedom, and equality in the Middle East as well as here at home. I think that the act I took of courageously standing up in front of Congress doesn't, the opportunity to do that doesn't come along very often, but every day as Americans we have an opportunity to stand up and whether it's putting our money where our hearts are by participating in economic pressure against Israel through the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, calling our Congress people or taking other actions, it's time for us to say no to this terrible policy that, just as Dr. Barghouti has illustrated, will not bring about peace. Netanyahu proved that he is the primary obstacle to peace and justice for Israelis and Palestinians. And to see our Congress giving away $3 billion of our tax dollars every year to Israeli war crimes while our economy suffers, while our kids can't go to college, while our needs aren't being met here at home is absolutely an outrage. The thing I want to say is that when I stood up and was tackled yesterday, it was by members of AIPAC. Yes.
What were you just saying? You were tackled by members of AIPAC?
I just wanted to say that the people that were sitting around me in the gallery of Congress were mostly wearing badges from the AIPAC Israel Lobby Conference, and I did not expect that people holding such power and representing such a huge lobby group would respond so violently to my peaceful disruption. And after I spoke out, Netanyahu said, you know, this is what's possible in a democracy, and you wouldn't be able to get away with this in other countries like Tunisia. And I think that is ridiculous and absurd. If this is what democracy looks like, that when you speak out for freedom and justice, you get tackled to the ground, you get physically violated and assaulted, and then you get hauled off to jail, that's not the kind of democracy that I think I want to live in.
Haaretz newspaper in Israel identified you as a Jewish American activist of Israeli descent. Is your family from Israel?
My father's family is from Israel, yes.
And what does it mean for you to speak out? Often in this country, the Jewish community is portrayed as monolithic when it comes toward to dealing with Israel policy and supporting the Israeli government. Your thoughts on that, and what does it mean for you to speak out with your family from Israel?
I've been to Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza several times, and after witnessing the destruction, the Jewish-only roads, the wall, the bombing of Gaza, and the inequality there, I feel like when I returned to the United States, I had no option but to speak out for justice. And I feel this tremendous responsibility as a Jewish American to speak out for justice and against these war crimes that are being committed in my name as a Jew, as a U.S. taxpayer. But it's not easy, for sure. There's a culture of silence and fear in the Jewish community around speaking out about this. And it's certainly, I get some blowback from family and friends, but I think it's so important to follow my principles, my integrity, and my heart. And I urge other, especially young Jews, to do the same. I think that us, as the next generation, we see things differently than the kind of brainwashing, or we call it blue washing, that that we've been fed sometimes by our congregations or by Israel. We have to see through the veil of religious narrative to see that what Israel is doing is not in the best interest of Judaism either. And you were just asking Mr. Barghouti about the Jewish state. I think that what Israel is doing is completely out of line with Jewish values. The value of tikkun olam, of repairing and healing the world, is totally absent from the Netanyahu administration.
Yemen today. Resistance fighters rained rockets on President Ali Abdullah Saleh's palace. The president, the prime minister, and the speaker all were wounded. The president, a man responsible for killing unarmed protesters, turned up in the hospital with wounds to his neck. Initial reports thought he had been killed. Oh well, maybe next time. Since unarmed protesters were slaughtered, armed struggle has come to Yemen, possibly in its place. Peshawar, Pakistan, today. The Taliban claims 50 fighters took part in the third day in a row of cross-border fighting, while the Pakistani government claims to have repelled about 400 Taliban fighters with helicopters and artillery. Pakistan, yesterday, hundreds of heavily armed Taliban fighters laid siege to a Pakistani checkpoint on the Afghan border for the second of 3 days of cross-border fighting, killing 28 police and 6 civilians in the deadliest fighting in months. A senior police official told the AFP Wire that 500 militants, including Afghan Taliban from across the border and Pakistani Taliban, took part in the attack, which began before dawn on Wednesday and continued more than 24 hours later. The Pakistani military sent reinforcements to the police checkpoint, deploying helicopter gunships, hoping to quell the attack in an area accessible on the ground only by foot. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. At least 3 bombings were reported in Baghdad, wounding 2 police officers and 9 civilians. Another bomb attached to a car exploded today, wounding 2 people. Ramadi, Anbar Province, Iraq, yesterday. A wave of bombings killed at least 7 people and wounded at least 25. The first 3 bombs went off near a compound housing the governor, police command, and several other security directorates, according to Al Jazeera's Omar Al-Saleh. The AP Wire reported a market was also near the bombings, and that the bomb explosions appeared coordinated to maximize deaths. A police official said two roadside bombs went off first, and then a parked car exploded when police arrived on the scene. Then another parked car bomb exploded near the hospital where the injured were taken, the official reported. Tikrit, Iraq, today. A bomb hidden in a fuel canister outside a mosque frequented by provincial officials was followed by a suicide bombing inside the hospital where the wounded were taken to finish them off. The first bomb killed at least 19 people, according to Iraqi police. The suicide bombing at the hospital killed at least 17 more people, and the pair of attacks left at least 74 people wounded. Kut, Iraq, Wednesday. A U.S. minesweeper was damaged by an explosive charge that blew up against an American Army patrol in southern Iraq's Numaya Township in Wasit Province on Wednesday, a Wasit police source reported. Quote, "The U.S. Army's minesweeper was set on fire and damaged when an explosive charge blew up against an American Army patrol in southern Iraq's Numaya Township in Wasit Province on Wednesday," a Wasit police source reported. He said the U.S. forces had beaten a number of police officers who were at the venue of the blast when it took place, giving no further details. Al-Qurna, Iraq, yesterday. An unknown group attacked a U.S. military convoy in Qurna with a grenade, U.S. forces reported. Kirkuk, Iraq, today. A U.S. military patrol was attacked today with a hand grenade, according to security forces. Wait a minute. What U.S. patrols? What grenades? What roadside bombs? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh yeah, that's been said before. Why then are 479 soldiers of Utah's National Guard, the 2nd Battalion of the Utah National Guard's 222nd Field Artillery, known as the Triple Deuce, preparing to deploy to Iraq? U.S. troops are supposed to be out of Iraq by the end of the year, and there is talk of a much wider war if they are not. Mr. Barack Obama, you got what you wanted in Pakistan, and nothing is changing in Iraq or Afghanistan, no matter how long U.S. troops stay, except how many people get killed. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today. Iraqi men were arrested in Bowling Green, Kentucky back in May. They are being charged in a grand jury indictment in U.S. domestic courts with supporting insurgents in their home country in occupied Iraq and with conspiring to bomb U.S. troops in Iraq, a country in which many people are engaged in a state of active warfare against the United States. In other words, U.S. domestic courts are claiming battlefield jurisdiction over the Iraq War. These two men are not charged with attempting to bomb anything or anyone inside the U.S. They are charged with trying to do something in Iraq, where U.S. courts are not supposed to have jurisdiction. The two men, Awad Ramadan Alwan, age 30, and Mohammed Sharif Hamadi, age 23. Assistant Attorney General Todd Heenan said, quote, "Over the course of roughly 8 years, Wad Ramadan Alwan allegedly supported efforts to kill U.S. troops in Iraq, first by participating in the construction and placement of improvised explosive devices in Iraq, and more recently, by attempting to ship money and weapons from the United States to insurgents in Iraq." Similar charges have been filed against Hamadi. Supporting evidence against Alwan includes a fingerprint on a shell recovered in Iraq, which is not some place the FBI or U.S. courts are supposed to have jurisdiction, except for U.S. military courts over offenses committed by members of the U.S. military. Alwyn was said to have been drawn into an FBI sting in which he boasted of attacking the U.S. Army in Iraq. In September 2010, Alwyn was said to have shipped money and weapons to Sunni insurgents in Iraq. Hey, Department of Justice and President Obama, how is it that U.S. courts do not have the jurisdiction to judge men being held without trial in Guantanamo Bay, supposedly captured on the battlefield, but do have jurisdiction over someone else on the battlefield? These two Iraqis should be considered soldiers of their country, every bit as much as the U.S. Navy SEALs who entered Pakistan on the mission to kill Osama bin Laden were soldiers of their country. They may even regard themselves as being on an anti-terrorism mission when you think about what the U.S. has done to Iraq. Therefore, the U.S. may, under the laws of war, either hold these men as declared prisoners of war and also grant prisoner of war status to all the men in Guantanamo Bay, or else grant trials in civilian court to every detainee in Guantanamo Bay, as well as to these two Iraqis. Many have argued that civilian trials for anyone captured on any battlefield will lead to court jurisdiction over every shell fired and every bomb dropped in every war. Many in the U.S., especially Republicans and members of the military, fear this scenario. Why then is it okay for Wad Ramadan Alwyn and Mohammad Sharif Hamadi to face charges in U.S. court, but not okay for those suspected of war crimes in Iraq, such as those infamous Blackwater contractors, to face trial in the civil courts of Iraq? Memorial Day, the 31st of May, 2011, Arlington Cemetery. President Obama made his usual President's Day appearance for the holiday at Arlington Cemetery, paying respect to young men sent to their graves, fighting in wars including his own. Unfortunately, three members of the violently anti-gay Westboro Baptist Church, notorious for protesting military funerals, showed up with their "God Hates Fags" signs. Worse yet, the Ku Klux Klan, that's right, the KKK, showed up as well, supposedly to counter-protest the Westboro bigots, but bearing another meaning for an African-American president.
We are with the Knights of the Southern Cross, soldiers of the Ku Klux Klan. We are here in protest of Westboro Baptist Church. I'm a veteran. I spent 9.5 years in the military.
You heard that. That was Dennis Labonte, Imperial Wizard of the KKK, or Ku Klux Klan, claiming to have served in the U.S. military. This raises two questions. One, why are members of the Ku Klux Klan, the Nazis, and other hate groups permitted to serve in the U.S. military? And two, how is it that the KKK was able to get into the Washington, D.C. area without attracting thousands of furious anti-Klan protesters like what happened in 1982 and 1990? Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT, Direct Action Radio in Exile. Over the internet, and returning to the air as soon as a new transmitter location and frequency can be found.
After nearly 2 years of living in exile after the June 28, 2009 coup, which overthrew his government, former Honduran President Manuel Zelaya returned to his nation on May 28. The agreement, which allowed for Zelaya's return, negotiated by the governments of Venezuela, Colombia, and current Honduran President Porfirio Lobo, dropped fraud charges lodged against Zelaya, permitted a future plebiscite on constitutional reform, and cleared the way for the readmission of Honduras to the Organization of American States, which lost its membership after the coup. Speaking to tens of thousands of supporters who met the former president at the capital city's airport in Tegucigalpa, Zelaya called for peaceful, democratic change, saying the problem of poverty, of corruption, will not be solved with violence, but through more democracy, greater citizen participation, and better transparency. Zelaya will now head the National Front for Popular Resistance, a coalition of civil society groups, labor unions, and farmers that challenged a 2009 coup. The populist leader says he wants to model the front in Honduras after the Uruguayan Broad Front, with the goal of winning national elections within 2 years. But while Zelaya's return has given hope to many Hondurans that political reform will soon follow, repression of opposition groups continues. Human rights groups have documented the murders of 8 journalists and dozens of members of the National Front for Popular Resistance, farmers and trade unionists, by paramilitary groups and police. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dana Frank, professor of history at University of California, Santa Cruz. She describes the significance of Zelaya's return to Honduras amid the growing repression.
The deal itself doesn't guarantee anything. It's just between Zelaya and Lobo. Lobo is the current de facto president of Honduras. I want to underscore that Lobo, the current president, was himself came to power in a completely fraudulent election supported by the United States that was controlled by the very same people who ran the military coup, and it was boycotted by both the Honduran opposition and by international observers. So he himself is a very much what we would consider the ongoing coup regime. So when we're talking about these negotiations, who is the legitimate president here is obviously a big question. But it's also really important to understand that this agreement does not in any way address the really terrifying human rights situation in Honduras. And I think most listeners are not aware that the repression of the opposition in the last 3 months is worse than it was after the coup. The Honduran military and police are now using tear gas canisters as lethal force. They've killed at least 2 people that way. They're using live ammunition. And it's been this war against the teachers unions in particular, but against the whole opposition. 5 more people were killed in the last 3 weeks, including 4 campesinos and 2 journalists. This has all been going on completely unreported in the U.S. media. For all the over 300 people that have been killed in the opposition since Lobo himself came to office, and that's not counting another 100 or so in the first end of the original coup, President Roberto Micheletti, no one has been charged for any of those crimes. No one has been prosecuted. No one has gone to jail. You could go out there tomorrow and assassinate a journalist or a teacher or a trade unionist or a campesino, and nothing will happen to you. This pact does nothing to address that really, really terrifying situation. It's really just about Zelaya coming back. Now, Zelaya coming back does mean a huge amount. He's the huge symbol of resistance to the coup, and he represents constitutional order and the rule of law, even for people who are quite critical of him. And he does change the political equation. There were some reports, like 1 million people that were in the streets. Even the right-wing pro-coup press reported between 500,000 to 1.5 million people on Saturday at the airport greeting Zelaya.
Dana, tell our listeners a bit about ousted President Zelaya upon his return to Honduras, maintaining that he was going to work hard to make the National Front for Popular Resistance, a coalition of grassroots groups that resisted the coup in Honduras, into an effective electoral coalition that could contest for power in the future, much like that which existed in or was formed in Uruguay in 2005.
Well, this is the $64,000 question on the ground in Honduras. It's really important for listeners to know that through the democratic process of its own decision-making process, the National Front of Popular Resistance had a big assembly in January in which it was agreed that they would not become an electoral party, that they really want to keep building their base as a social movement. And the Frente includes the women's movement, the GLBT movement, the campesina movement, the indigenous movement, the Afro-indigenous peoples, the labor movement, all these widely diverse groups within our sort of fantasy social movement up here, right? Those people have very serious commitment to horizontal politics and to building the base from below. People in the resistance are very wary of becoming a revived liberal party that would be back to the square one of having this very deep patronage politics, because the party in power controls thousands and thousands of jobs immediately and then can parcel them out to its members. And no one wants the Frente in the resistance to just morph back into a revived liberal party. And there are lots of people, the so-called liberals in resistance, that were party functionaries that are part of the broad umbrella of the resistance and the Frente that have been pushing for over a year now for the Frente to go into electoral politics. So, you're not even getting that reported that they actually voted not to do it in February. Zelaya just forced their hand with all this massive publicity about politics. And there's no question that the whole political framework just changed in the last week because of this deal and his return. And I think people are now like reeling, because a lot of people like Copin, one of the indigenous groups, and artists in resistance, a lot of people have said, wait a minute, we never agreed to this. This is not our pact. The Frente never approved the pact, and we never agreed to go into electoral politics. I think it's quite possible that the train has already left the station, that there's this now steamrolling in place, and people may have to accept that framework. It's going to be very powerful how this plays out in the next month. Because, of course, the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton, they very much want a two-party system. They want some kind of revived two-party system. They don't care what its politics are. They just want it to look like there's democracy in Honduras. And remember that the Lobo government, which is controlled by the military, the military controls the state-owned telephone company, they control the airports, they control the immigration service, one of the same generals that ran the coup is in charge of the armed forces. They count the ballots. So what does it mean to go into politics if you can't actually have a free and fair election? The presidential elections are not until 2014, so we're way in advance. But this is what people are going to need to watch while also paying attention to the human rights situation, which is a separate issue, but obviously it's all rolled in together.
That was Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Find links to Frank's recent articles on our website at btlonline.org.
Jared Ball, DJ Munch, Chocolate City, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Something.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave labors. Craftsmanship, low price to flip, to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave.
Uh-huh.
Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize,
yeah,
soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them
for
being paid less than their male equivalent.
On these issues and more,
we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me.
They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step 1, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step 2, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step 3, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart. It's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holler black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, Sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee a plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunist out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
There are those who say you can't fight City Hall. There are those who say protesting is a waste of time. In DC, however, they've just been proven wrong. When DC Council Chairman Kwame Brown proposed to close all homeless shelters to avoid raising taxes on the rich, about 200 protesters swarmed the Wilson Building. When they went to Kwame Brown's office, some warned that if homeless people were turned out of shelters, riots would be next.
There were tent cities, and that's what this city's gonna turn into if we don't save these benefits and shelters for people to live in. Now, also, after Dr. King's death, there were riots, or at least a riot, a terrible riot that affected a large part of the city. That can also happen. So you either go to jail now or you go to jail next year.
They got that about the riots. As a result, Kwame Brown threw in a towel. The shelters will stay open. He still chose to nickel and dime the middle class with fees instead of taxing the rich. But remember, it wasn't the middle class saying they would riot. And it wasn't the middle class looking at sleeping outdoors every night except during hypothermia season. Protest works. You can fight City Hall. Don't just vote. Organize. Get together with your neighbors and those you know the most. Stand up to Walmart. Stand up to City Hall.
When the Republican-controlled House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed Wisconsin GOP Representative Paul Ryan's budget proposal that would have dismantled Medicare and defunded Medicaid, many inside the Beltway journalists and media pundits praised the legislation as bold, innovative, and courageous. But when the public learned more details about the measure, which would transform Medicare from a program that pays the medical bills of senior citizens over 65 years of age into a voucher system that provides inadequate subsidies to purchase private insurance coverage, public sentiment quickly soured. Republican legislators who voted for the bill were soon confronted by angry constituents who were anxious that the government programs they value and depend on would soon disappear. Public anger also greeted other elements of the GOP-passed budget that would have further reduced the tax burden on the nation's wealthiest citizens and big corporations, even as it made dramatic cuts to many social safety net programs like food stamps without reducing the deficit for 10 years. A special election on May 24th in New York State's 26th Congressional District, a longtime GOP stronghold, was viewed by many as a referendum on the Republicans' frontal attack on government entitlement programs like Medicare. when the underdog Democratic Party candidate won in a three-way race. Political observers pronounced the Republicans' decision to balance the budget on the backs of grandma and grandpa as a major strategic mistake that may cause the party major losses in the 2012 congressional election. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Damon Silvers, policy director with the AFL-CIO. He discusses the fallout from the GOP budget and concerns that congressional Democrats and the president will negotiate concessions with Republicans that could compromise Medicare and Social Security.
The Republican budget proposes not just reducing the funding to these programs, it proposes fundamentally changing what Medicare is from a program that guarantees to pay for health care regardless of how expensive it gets to essentially a voucher program. It changes it from genuine social insurance into simply a payment, and a payment which the Republicans propose to shrink as the cost of medical care grows, so that over time it would become really an insignificant form of economic security for older Americans. This is obviously a radical program designed to dismantle the key ways, perhaps insufficient ways, but the key ways in which our government helps look after all of us around the things that we desperately need to avoid, you know, lives of hardship in old age, and to do so to benefit the wealthy. And not surprisingly, when voters in New York State, in a special election in a overwhelmingly Republican House district, when voters were asked, are you for this or not, in the context of the fact that the Republican candidate in that district was for the Ryan Plan and the Democratic candidate was against the Ryan Plan, this overwhelmingly Republican district elected a Democratic candidate.
When you look at the concern expressed by many people about statements made by Democratic House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer, some recent comments by former President Bill Clinton, Vice President Joe Biden, and Barack Obama, telling the country that, yes, Medicare and Medicaid are on the table in budget negotiations. Does that concern you that the Democrats may be gearing up to cave in and pander to the Republicans or meet them halfway at any rate?
The question of what to make of various statements that have been put on the table by different Democratic politicians and ex-politicians. Here's what I think is really important. There is a part of the Republican Party that simply doesn't believe that in America we ought to take any responsibility for each other. There's a part of the Republican Party that really believes that our motto as a nation ought to be each of us is completely on our own. And those folks don't like Medicare and Medicaid, never have, haven't liked it since it was created. And they look for any excuse to try to destroy it. There are some Democrats, I'm afraid, who are not prepared to talk about the adequate levels of taxation that are going to be necessary to support this kind of basic social insurance that's necessary for us to be a civilized society. The labor movement is confident that at the end of the day, President Obama is supportive of these basic values that really define what makes modern America a fair society to the extent it is, and that he's going to stand up and defend Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And so far, we think he's done so. But as President Trump has said at this press event, you know, every day is a new day, and we are watching.
As you mentioned a moment ago, Damon, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka denounced Republicans and their plans to gut Medicare and Medicaid and warned the Democrats that the union movement could withhold support from Democrat incumbents who don't fight aggressively enough to challenge the Republicans' attack on Medicare and Medicaid. What would you like to see the union movement do to step up a challenge to the Republicans in their agenda right now?
Well, what President Trump had talked about at the press club last week, he made those remarks in the context of laying out an ambitious agenda for strengthening the labor movement's capacity both to support politicians that help working people, oppose those that hurt working people, but more importantly, to enact working people's agenda. We do not have in the short term a fiscal crisis. All right, that's a lie. All right, what we have in the short term is a jobs crisis. It's very unfortunate that President Obama has not been clear about this, and that to some extent he has repeated Republican talking points on this matter. But if you go talk to serious economists, there's really not much debate about this. We have 9% unemployment. As a formal matter, we have something like 15-16% unemployment. In real terms, our economy is weak. Right? It is the worst possible time in which to engage in fiscal austerity. Fiscal austerity will cost us jobs on a large scale. And the people who advocate it think that there'll be long-term beneficial consequences. They don't disagree. In the short term, jobs will be destroyed. This is the worst possible time to do this. However, it is true that we have been running large budget deficits for years, since George Bush became president. And those large budget deficits are about three things. They're about Bush's tax cuts for the wealthy, which have now been extended for 2 years. They're about the fact that somewhere between 10 and 20% of our workforce is not working and not paying taxes. And they're about the fact that we continue to be at war in Afghanistan and Iraq. Those are the reasons why we've been running budget deficits. And unfortunately, the public debate right now is not about fixing really any of those things. And the one we must start with, without which we will not fix anything, is the fact that millions of our fellow citizens who want to work, who want a job, cannot find one today. That for every job opening, there are five people looking for a job. That is what is wrong with our economy today. That is the center of what is wrong with our economy. And the talk about deficits is nothing but an ideological agenda aimed at turning this country into a dog-eat-dog society for the benefit of the wealthy. It will not fix our economy. It will make it worse.
That was Damon Silvers, policy director with the AFL-CIO. Read more about the budget debate and Medicare on our website at btlonline.org.